Interesting questions. You shouldn't take an authoritarian stance when you're asking me that. You should actually be interested in what the answer is. And when you do get some kind of answer, then the next thing you should do is ask yourself, is there a better way to accomplish this? Do you understand? So what am I clinging to? I'm clinging to my cup of tea.
Don't look at my tea!
Is there a better way to accomplish this? Oh, yes. You understand? Usually what happens... Now, this is a very Buddhist approach. This is how the Buddhist approach goes. It goes like this. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So you start. First of all, if you are doing things that overwhelm you with guilt or continuously split the world into right and wrong, and you've decided things that you can't be right, you're going to be more wrong than anybody else around you, sabotaging relationships, you understand what I'm saying? Like that kind of stuff. Cease to do evil. Make rules and keep them. Little rules. Okay, I'm not going to mug any old men. You set a time on it. Because if part of your identity has been involved with acts of violence or unworthiness, distrustfulness, then you need to think to yourself that you're not going to do it forever because that just sets up too much pressure. So you set a time on it. And when you've managed to do that for that time, you congratulate yourself. You name it. You name it. You say, I did that. And then you see, you get the feeling of doing it. That can build. When that builds for long enough, there comes to be a point where you don't need to do that anymore because you know you're good. So you don't have to anymore observe that. An example of this, I went one time, I had been living in New Zealand for a while, and then I came back to Canada. And I met some friends that I had known 10 or 12 years before, and they invited me for dinner. We went for dinner, we finished dinner, and they brought out the acid. And I started laughing. I said, acid? Oh, excuse me, that's so funny. You know, and there wasn't anything in me that thought that it was a good idea to take myself out of there in order to have a good time. Do you understand? It wasn't even the slightest temptation. It was just funny. It's like, oh, and then I'm looking at them saying, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, excuse me, but maybe I should just go. Because it was so funny to me. So there was no effort involved at that point. So I didn't have to cease to do evil at that point, you see? Instead of which, I became aware of how they felt. So I could start to learn to do good. I could start to care for them. I could start to reach out a bit and think, well, what's good for you? In that case, I did actually just leave after, I waited a couple hours until they were into that drug wrap, and nobody would have noticed whether I was there or not. went to a movie. is at least as good. But that's, you see, that's, that will naturally occur if you are careful with yourself. So if you ask what you're clinging to or what you're afraid of, and if you find that what it is something that you don't think kindly about in yourself, could be one of your secret vices or something, you understand? Then put a time limit on it and practice it in a less painful way. You understand? Adjust it to something you can do. Don't get the rod out, the authoritarian, and beat yourself. It's useless. Because you want to do that for a little while, and then you'll... What you want to do is grow yourself. You don't want to cut down the rest of the forest so you look big. Well, maybe you do, but I recommend you don't. Yeah, the topsoil runs off and you get damn parched. And so it naturally, that naturally moves into learn to do good, where you actually want to help others, you actually want to, you actually feel that as your joy. Look, this works for me. Here, let me open the door for you. Can you see it? In a lot of different ways. Where you actually are interested in somebody who thinks differently than you. What a concept. You think that way. I mean, wow. Tell me about that. Now, there is a real interest, a real involvement. And then that turns at a certain point where your sense of joy is no longer concerned with self or other. And you start saying, what's mind? What's consciousness? What's going on here? You actually start saying that. What's happening? And so then, whether you're watching mind there or here, it doesn't make any difference because you've purified yourself of position and therefore the mind is pure. Now that's a big jump. We usually do, cease to do evil, learn to do good pretty good. We can whip back and forth between those two without a lot of trouble. But when it comes to just watching what is mind without grasping, without having a position, that's a real jump. One of the reasons why you do it is because you're bored with doing good. You realize, okay, I'm doing good, but it's not really much good. Do you understand? You don't feel like what you're doing has any fire to it? You ever had a job where you felt like you, there was no point in doing it anymore? That's when you're at that point, you see, where you need to go to a deeper level. You need to, because it's pretty hot there, isn't it?
No, it's just quite stretching itself.
Okay. So purify the mind in its most simple description is let go of knowing and study mind. That's very beautiful. Very subtle, but very difficult. Because you're not getting caught by appearance anymore. You're not believing in thing anymore. Therefore, you are going away from duality. You want to know what is the source, what is not. And when you work with that and work with that, then every once in a while, until it is really true, comes the fourth line. This is the teaching of all the Buddhists. It's not dependent on appearance, and it's not dependent on non-appearance. It's just this. I think that four-line verse sums up the Buddha's teaching better than any other. Piece of Buddha Dharma I've ever heard. It's just very straightforward. There are days when you get up and you have to know whether it's a cease to do evil day, a learn to do good day, a purify the mind day, or this is a teaching of all the Buddhas day. And sometimes, you know, 2 hours into it, it'll change. I definitely know that there are days when I get up and I say, oh, look in the mirror and say, hi there, cease to do evil. Oh, and by the way. It's hard to fool yourself, isn't it? You just look at those eyeballs and you know. Oh, we're going to learn to do good. Oh, excellent. I like them. How sad is that?
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else have a question?
What was the fourth one?
Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Purify the mind. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas.
Oh, so there's only three?
I don't know.
Think.
This exists.
Oh, okay.
I think probably the fourth is experience. But so is the first, second, and third.
Yeah.
I think by the time you get to the fourth, there is no sense of separation. So it's not something that you are doing. It's just what is. It's just this thusness. But it's a pretty straightforward path, eh?
Yeah, it's simple.
Yeah.
Even I could grasp it.
It's very beautiful, very beautiful. I used to have it on my wall all the time. Any other questions? No? Questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Take them all.
Prior to evening, you just said something quickly about the nature of the void. I used a different term, and it was about potentiality. It sounded slightly to me a bit like the notion of entelechy, but I wasn't sure.
That's pretty good.
And I was just wondering if you could say a bit more about it.
Yeah. In erudite Buddhist tradition, there are four voids. I think there's probably only three, and then the fourth is like a summation, a realization. And it's very like, do you know anything about Kabbalistic tradition?
Not much. I would assume nothing.
Because they have in the Kabbalistic tradition, they have this tree.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen any pictures of it? Or
yes.
Uh-huh. And it has 10 what they call the sephirah, which are like principles, isn't it? Would that be a good translation? The sephirah? Like principles, almost? Their principles are qualities of the Godhead, the Jehovah, the Yahweh. The Yahweh. And how the Yahweh manifests in different principles. And the 10 go Kether, which is crown, Chokmah, and Bina. And then there is a kind of a separation, and then there's 7. But if you look further into the tree, there are 3 previous to the 3 and then the 7. Okay? And these 3 are called Ein, Ein Sof, and Ein Sof Aleph, which are 3 manifestations of void nature. Does that sound a little familiar to you? There's
no,
something
it means not.
Not, yeah, without. Nothing. And Ein Sof, the wisdom of nothing, would be like the cognition flooding nothing. And Ein Sof, what would the R be? A-U-R, it's spelled in English. It would be the potential arising, the potential of anything arising because of the wisdom nature. Here, we'll go at it another way, because I love going at things another way. And I'm sitting here. At one point in the Tibetan tradition, if you wish to evoke great skillfulness and understanding of how all the interstices of existence flash in and out of nothingness, all of the laws that call something into being and have it pass away, if you want to invoke the greatest power of naming possible, if you own something's name, you have a connection to it, after all. You know what you do? You chant the alphabet. Because all possible wordings and namings, the potential of every word, every piece of wisdom, is in the alphabet. So you can look at the alphabet as meaningless, or you can look at the alphabet as ripe all wisdom. So that's what the third void is like. First void is nothing. Second void is like conscious nothing. Third void is like potentially full of what could be arising with consciousness, nothing. But they're all nothing. There is no thinging in any of them.
So the third is the combination of the first two?
Not precisely. It could certainly be. Not precisely. Not precisely. I wouldn't want to say that. But because there are 3, then there is the creative springing forward. And then you get Kether, Chokmah, Bina. And then you get the 7 planetary spheres. Or the 7 wisdoms of God, whatever you want to call it. In other teachings. And in the Tibetan, in fact, the Green Tara that we do tomorrow, there's one verse that talks about Tara whose wisdom invokes, can call all the beings in the 7 planetary spheres. Can call all of the manifest principles of God in manifest. Which is everything. Potentially. Yeah.
So, what I was wondering then, that's useful to me, because I was wondering also on body, you know, you had mentioned sort of the Buddhist, not maybe perhaps definition, but I would say definition or description of self, as sort of three moments or momentums. One sort of karmic from the sort of the past, and so I was wondering how that fit with how this description of the voidness or the potentiality arising was in that forward thrust of intention. I was wondering what the relationship there was.
The relationship of shunya to form is continuous, unchanging, unalterable. So it isn't only to a self, but within the self. Yeah, see this cup? See what's in it? Tell me what's in it. Can't see it? Pass it back. What's in it? Just look at how it is.
Some liquid.
Yeah.
Some sort. Maybe tea. Maybe.
Anything else?
Whiskey.
Stains.
Stain.
Space.
Space. Space air. Space air. Space. Where does the space stop? Is there space all the way through the cup? Even? Between the molecules? Space between the nucleus of the molecule and the whizzing around of neutrons and protons?
Not from the perspective of the natural attitude,
not from
the
natural not from the perspective of a cup which I'm using for this function, but if I drop it, the space will be a lot more clear, won't it?
Right.
There'll still be pieces, but I can keep dropping it. And one way or the other, in time, it will move to space. Because the space is a permanent. And it in the space can arise any form. Is the space any different inside and outside? That's the next question, you see. Isn't that an interesting question? Is the space any different in that cup?
In my lungs right now. I just took the space from the cup and put it in my lungs. Oh, now it's in my bloodstream. Oh my god.
Oh my god. Oh my god. It's kind of an interesting little play there, isn't it? If you let your mind play it a bit. I just breathed it out, but you breathed in. You got a cup space in your body. The sense of distinction is impermanent and illusory. Space is said to be the container, the separator. The void nature of space, the void nature, is said to be the one of the two aspects of reality. One of the two aspects of reality. One is void nature, the other is cause and effect, dancing, interstices, dancing, coming into being, existing, passing away. There are many people who say you should not accept any limits. There are many people who say bliss and shunyata are where it's at. They got half the story. There are many people who say what is important is feeding the children, paying the taxes. They got half the story. There are very few people who say bliss is everything, especially if you're trying to pay the taxes. They're getting close. And there are very few people who say there is no position worth clinging to, because trying to make the impermanent permanent creates pain. Trying to make the impure pure creates pain. Isn't that amazing? Trying to make that which is not a permanent self into a permanent self creates pain. That does not deny self, that denies the permanence of dancing cause and effect. So if you see the world as a weave, you begin to understand shunya as not separate from self. And so it's a little bit like, what was his name? Eisenberg? Do you know, I like to dabble in physics because I like to prove how unintelligent I am. And it's not too hard if you use physics. And genetics, too, is another one I like to play around with every once in a while. Because then I can be convinced of how I'm glad I never tried to go to university or anything like that. You know, it sort of supports my tripping around. And but then I read things like Eisenberg. It's called the Uncertainty Principle, isn't it?
Heisenberg,
thank you. And at one moment you have a point, and the next moment you have a wave. Kind of sounds like shunya to me. And you look at it this way: if this is your purpose, this is what occurs. If this is your purpose, this is what occurs. And then the question is, what is mind, or what is purpose? You see, what is mind? What is it that is looking? What is purpose? How does activity originate or whatever? So now, what you were going to, you're dying to ask a question here. So
it's what I was thinking about as this is good for me. But what I was thinking was that it was, if I'm not sure how you're saying shunya, if this voidness, nature, whatever, is may I use? Because I don't have
anything. Use anything.
I'll say moments of whatever.
Of whatever.
Well, you said self, but so what I felt was it was really fascinating if that was identical with if the void nature was that forward movement around intentionality, because it decenters the self immediately, anyways. So that I thought it was very clever, or I don't mean clever, but I do actually. I mean clever, mm-hmm. Because it creates a perceptual momentum constantly, which is very interesting. So I was just trying to see if I understood what you're saying.
Not quite.
Yeah.
But that is really interesting what you're saying, where you've taken it. That is a really interesting, and that'll be nice, fruitful for you to play around with a bit. That isn't exactly what I'm saying. What I'm saying is there are two principles to reality. You look at it one way, it has one principle, you look at it another, it has another. There are two principles. One is the void, the boundless state, void nature, boundless state. No time, no differentiation. Void nature. And the other is cause and effect dancing.
And I don't want to take too long in the question.
If anybody doesn't like it, they can just tell me.
My curiosity is, it just seems that it's still, when you say, well, there are two, or that's half of the story, that we're staying still within a binary oppositional model at some level,
yeah.
Whereas I wish to
exactly.
Not be at all caught within binary opposition.
Exactly. And then the other thing they say in Buddhism, which is really interesting, is they say the Buddhist teaching was designed for the human consciousness, which is binary. Oh. Now there's a monkey wrench.
So that it was designed at a certain time, it rose at a certain time when consciousness was binary.
It is binary.
Do you imagine that consciousness still is?
I think so, don't you? You don't think so?
I hope not.
Could you explain that, please, binary?
Go
ahead. Explain binary for Blaine.
I just mean it, flat-footed pedestrian dualities.
Okay.
You know, good and evil, dark and light, or any sorts of binary is a switching off between the two. I think that I'm reading it very simply. But I don't, for me, I don't believe that. I don't think that the consciousness is binary. And so, and I think that in fact...
Okay. If you're saying binary, so it has to be either or, but what if it's binary, so it can perceive with both? Would that make it tertiary? Would that make it a threefold consciousness?
At least.
Yes, of course. But for most people, when they see I don't see that, that's binary. Subject-object. What you're working with is subject-object. Do you have a problem with that? Is that straightforward? Is anybody getting bored with this conversation? It's an interesting conversation. And it goes right to the heart of what things you want to know about. Because there is no death unless there's a self. There's no self without subject-object.
So are you saying that the teachings are geared towards the way in which we think? That's what you're saying.
Two things. There are two things that the teachings are geared toward. To resolve conflicting emotional states, which create the motive for us having fixed views and not being able to see things as they are. So the teachings are meant to do two things. To resolve conflicting emotional states and to loosen fixed views. Those are two things, and that is what the Buddha said. This teaching was designed for humans for these two purposes. To loosen conflicting emotional states. He called a conflicting emotional state anything that wasn't loving-kindness, which is a boundless state, compassion, which is a boundless state, sympathetic joy, which is a boundless state, but equanimity, which is a boundless state. So you can see what a difficulty you have if you're trying to translate some Buddhist teachings into the Western tradition, where there is a much richer vocabulary for emotion. Whereas in the Buddhist tradition, they have many, many words for consciousness or mind, and very few in English. So it's really interesting, you know, trying to translate these ideas within that actually have a different language structure a lot of the time for talking about them. So that's also a difficulty in some of the ideas here. But I think that if you understand what I mean by binary is when the world is continuously split into subject-object, and then that is held to as true, rather than dissolve into totality and then a new subject-object arise. She's getting very embarrassed, so we'll just...
No, I'm loving it. This is fascinating. Philosophically, within the mainstream tradition, I was doing all work that was all about how consciousness itself is not binary, and how, you know, and so. But I was doing it not from the perspective that you're doing it. I was doing it with a different vocabulary.
Right.
And
yeah.
But I think that the temptation is to reify consciousness itself. So
yeah.
I think, and I would want to resist that.
Yeah.
But at least I would say that maybe, and I'm, you know, just new here to listen to you, I think that that you know, teaching arose at a certain moment in time, but consciousness itself, if it's boundless or limitless at some level, may transcend through the teaching such that, you know, the possibility of omniperceptual
capability
arises.
Yeah, that's absolutely the end result. That's absolutely the end result, that the person is no longer caught in the human dilemma of subject-object and fixing in that. That they become a Buddha. And that is considered to be the end result of all consciousness, whatever form it takes. Cockroach, that the ultimate end of all consciousness or end isn't exactly right. The ultimate experience that all consciousness will come to, is total awakening. Because all experience, all cause and effect. Here, this is how that's done. Do you want to hear how that's done? This is very nice. Do you want to hear it?
I would like to hear it.
Yeah. Because all beings desire pleasure. That's why. Because it is true that all beings desire pleasure, all beings will awaken. Because there is no greater pleasure than the experience of totality consciousness without being caught in conflicting emotional states. So the experience of life itself leads to awakening. It's just a matter of how long you want to take. Like, how many times you gonna try hammering the nail with your hand holding the head of the hammer? You know? Before you start saying, you know, one time you drop the hammer and hits your toe, breaks your toe, and you say, "Ouch, that was heavy," and you go, "Gee, maybe if I reverse the hammer," or somebody comes along and says, "Hey, you know," in like 3 years earlier, somebody comes along and says, "Hey, turn the hammer around and see what happens." You know? That's what it's a matter of. It's just a matter of how soon. That is the basic Buddhist traditional view, that all beings are destined to awaken. It's just a matter of how many brick walls you want to pass through before you try a doorway. that's the basic statement, because inherently we know the state, but we are all consciousness knows the state, but in a human body these are the propensities that tend to happen, duality. So this is a good teaching to move the dualistic mind to the state where it gets a view of the doorway.
So what we're saying here is, like, in a sense, I'm sort of like, now that this question arose this afternoon, like, now that I'm awakened to the idea that I'm sort of like, to use the term, trapped in this dualism of binary consciousness, how in the hell do I get out? And the question was thrown at me. It was a very good question, because I thought to myself, well, is it for me now to renounce this world, or to just sort of, That's another form of aversion, isn't it? To sort of push it away and saying, this is not what I want, and how do I get out of it? Or
this is a really beautiful question, Elaine, and it's a very difficult question, because it is a personal question for each of us, and we have to really hold the integrity of our own heart at this one. And that's where those two questions, what am I afraid of and what am I clinging to, come in. And then it requires honesty. It requires real honesty. Because if I'm afraid of something, is this a wise time for me to avoid it? You know? I'll tell you, I spent almost 2 years living in Thailand in the monasteries, which is not so long. But it's long enough to get a couple of ideas. I went there with $30, which was enough to buy robes. And I bought robes. And then the people that had told me I could come to that monastery and be ordained, when I got there, they weren't there. And nobody spoke English. So I had about 3 weeks with my material for robes. And no money to go anywhere. And I was on my own. And I met people there, mostly monks, who were using that system in the most beautiful, respectable way. That gave me such joy, because it's basically a place where you can go and practice. And the community supports it, because the community in the Buddhist countries actually feels that the job of the people who are the Sangha, like me, is to do whatever we can to focus our minds to gain spiritual insight and become more compassionate and share that with you, because you don't feel you have the time right now to work that way in your life. Your spiritual practice is having a family or having a job that's very important to you, and you want to do that. So I'll go out and sit there and meditate and do this study and spend hours doing that, and I'll come and tell you, I'll give you the fruit of my labor. And you come back with a bowl of soup and listen to me, and you give me the fruit of your labor. And sometimes I don't do a good job, so you say, you know, I think you're not paying attention to your... Here, here's 3 days worth of soup. Go and work a little harder. Because I'm not satisfied. And sometimes I come back and I say, boy, I'm really hungry. I've got something to tell you, but I got to eat first. And you say, oh, well, I haven't really been working much. And I say, I'm not going to bother trying to help you out of your suffering if you don't feed me. I mean, go out there and get some food from somebody and come back here and feed me, because I need it in order to go further. You see? It's a relationship that goes like that. And if it goes well, everybody benefits. Because every once in a while, somebody who's in there being a monk or a nun says, I need to live with a family for a while. I'm getting a very warped view. Which is true. Or every once in a while, somebody who's working in the world says, I need to go retire and sit under a tree for a while. I'm getting a very warped view. Which is true. So on each side of that, there's a community ready to welcome you and support you. On each side of that, it's an equal opportunity employee-employer relationship. And it's hard to say who's employing who when it works well. When it works well. It doesn't always work well. I met an awful lot, and a very often English, which was really interesting, but a few good Canadians. And only monks, but that's because there weren't very many nuns. Westerners, who could sit on a bed of nails, not looking at women, not eating, not enjoying the smell of the flowers, for longer periods of time, while meditating, without sleeping, for 20, 30 days in a row, because their fear and hatred of that letting go of purpose was so overwhelming. They could not let go of purpose in order to dissolve into the intimacy with the moment. You understand? So everything in them was like they could be more correct about the rules. You know? Like talk about your, you know, ability to cut off the sensual. Woo! They were bleeding to death before my very eyes. And they would get dry and hard and just packed. And they could always find one more rule that they weren't quite obeying properly, you know. Like those whips were out. But what about compassion? They had law down, but they didn't have compassion. So, you know, all of that is possible. And the universe will take care of it.
Sort of follow your heart then.
Follow your heart and be willing to ask those two questions. Follow your heart so that you can be honest about yourself. And you know, I'm in the monastery, and you know what keeps coming up? But, you know, I never really did get married. I mean, I never really did get married. So I left the monastery and got married. And after my 6 years, my marriage broke up, and I've never had that fantasy again. I'm only talking about myself. And I hope you're all involved in really excellent relationships. If you are. But I tell you one thing about a relationship that is really very, very interesting is that if you are in a relationship, it has greater possibility and greater difficulty than living on your own. Because if there are two of you together in a relationship, you're together because of your blind spots as well as because of your love. And when one of you starts getting a little bit restless about your blind spots and starts to change them, the other one is going to be irritated. And that irritation will either move them to start working on their blind spots or to attack you for doing, causing them problems. So if you have a real contract to try to be honest with each other, you know, a relationship guarantees that you'll work really well together. If you, you know, if you keep that sense of that also spiritual work is important in both your lives and you respect each other's limits and you're willing to let each other go if you need to. Do you understand that? Because it really can be hard sometimes when one person is going someplace and your lives are involved, your lives are tied together. So it's a great, you know, many people think that you cannot have a spiritual life if you're sexually involved. That's not true. Most often what happens in those cases is that sexuality becomes secret. And that's poisonous. That's not fair. That's not fair to the people who love the illusion of some pure person without genitals. No, it's not fair to support their ignorance. Is it? Is it? I don't think so.
Hey, I got them. Different than yours. Praise the Lord. I did it right this lifetime.
Can you imagine all this and testosterone? I mean, no. That would be
bad. That's okay. Doug's going to get down the mud.
I've been in some of my most atrocious states this time. you can listen to it over and over again. Blackmail me when I become pure. Should that ever occur. All things being possible, it's possible.
What do you mean in terms of relationship with the aspect of letting go and the limits?
That if someone is really going to move beyond the limits that you want to move beyond, you respect them. Because if you really love somebody, you're not afraid to lose. If you really love somebody, you wish them to complete their desires. That doesn't mean you don't grieve. It means you actually love them. You can see them. That your sense of security is not more important than theirs. So that's a big demand in a relationship. The other thing I'd like to say is that in fact, it is very important, I think, to be able to do both, spend time on retreat in a sort of spiritual setting and spend time totally immersed in society. And in my life, that's how I've tried to run my practice. I read many, many years ago when I was living in Japan about the practice going from the mountaintop to the marketplace, to the mountaintop, to the marketplace, until there was no difference. And that really impressed me. That really impressed me. And I thought, yeah, that's right. I want to be able to walk everywhere so there is no difference. I don't think I'll do it this lifetime, but I'm certainly seeding the aspiration, so whoever I am making, whoever inherits this rotten sense of humor,
we'll get a few up trips too.
Okay. I hope I haven't answered your question.
No, just more questions.
Oh, excellent. I'm doing an excellent job. Does anyone else have anything they want to ask? So tell me about taste. Thought I forgot, didn't you? Or did you forget? Who forgot? You forgot?
Yeah.
Oh, Terry! Tailored for you!
I was up this afternoon and then I...
You weren't eating, right?
I was away from it. And I wanted to do it.
At least you thought about it, folks. Who tried it? Tell me.
Well, I tried it at the same time I was reading a book. Didn't work very well.
No kidding.
It was a good book.
Why?
I thought of it at one point and I had the intention of doing it. I was sitting with the book and it was like I couldn't gather enough energy to sort of separate from it and just focus on the activity itself. So I began focusing on each bite.
And how far did you get? How many bites did you get that way?
Probably about six.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
That is not bad, actually. Who else? Did you try it? Tell me.
Just a few bites.
How many bites did you manage?
About four, but not all at the same time. In front of it a couple of different times when I was using consistency.
It's hard to remember, isn't it?
Orange is good for that, though.
Oh, anything else you noticed, Thomas?
It's a neat feeling to have when you're completely... Because Scott actually says you need contact, and that's more what it is. Just when you take that, and you feel all the texture, the kind of ground.
That's very different, isn't it? From the usual way one eats.
Mm-hmm.
Who else tried it? You tried it, Susie? Yeah, you tried it?
You and you were talking about before setting up a time limit. That's why you told us to try just one meal, right? Because I've tried to do that before, but I tried to do it all the time.
Yeah.
But now I'm always going to try and concentrate on what I eat and actually be there when I'm eating, and I could never do it.
Exactly.
Like I would remember once a month maybe and 1.5 bites and I'm off.
Yeah.
And I noticed, I got through half an apple, but I noticed how the beginning of each bite was so easy to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
But the ending of each bite felt boring.
Yeah.
And I would make myself go, well, why is it boring? Because the initial crispness and the initial tanginess is gone, and what's left is this sort of mushy feeling, and
yes.
And
yes.
I want to do something else. So
I wanted to. This is very interesting. Who else? Did you do it?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, sort of just like a couple bites at a time. But,
what happened?
Oh, I don't know. I wasn't able not to sort of taste it the whole time.
What do you mean you weren't able not to taste it?
Well, it wasn't like diminishing. I didn't find myself getting bored towards the end.
So how many bites did you manage?
Probably 3 or 4. But we weren't trying to like count how many we could do.
No, I meant. I said eat a meal.
Yeah.
So
every like you'd be chewing the one chew, you just like didn't notice that you're really paying attention.
And then your mind would go away, and then you'd notice, and then your mind would go away. And then you would notice, and then your mind would go away. Now at least be curious about why your mind went away. It's a very interesting thing. Just because it's a habit doesn't mean you can't be conscious of it. It's a very interesting thing to work on. Who else did it? Yes?
Yeah, it was, I had to wonder whether it was the attention of the mind that was causing this sort of dullness of the taste progressively. Or whether was it the quality of the attention? I mean, was the attention that was bringing to it that gave?
This is very interesting.
Or was it just that the taste buds were getting desensitized through the process? It was hard to know which it was.
It's very interesting. Okay, I'm not going to talk about this exercise. I just want you to do this. You know, once in a while, say, okay, today I'm going to eat a meal, and I'm going to try to watch every bite and be there. Be conscious of everybody. You want to learn something about mind. This one is a little bombshell, this exercise. I highly recommend it. If it weren't a book, it would be something else. I guarantee it. You want to look at the mind. You want to look at the mind that's doing that. There's something very interesting going on there. Have I got you a little inspired here to have a look? This is worth about a 3-week retreat, just as if you just do this. Just be curious and keep trying and see what happens. You'll learn something very interesting. Okay, what about the glass of water? What? Who did the glass of water? Thank you. Two of you? Who remembers the glass of water?
3 times.
You remember the 3 times? Who remembers it now? Who doesn't remember it at all? Isn't that interesting? That was the last one I gave you. I said, I want you, when you go home, to pour a glass of water with ice in it. Put it on the table and go do something for 5 minutes until you forget about the feel of it. Then come back, sit in front of it. Imagine picking up the glass. Think about the whole thing. And then after you've thought up the whole thing of tasting it, everything, then do it. And then ask yourself, what's the difference between and... Okay? You got that exercise now?
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, it seemed to be fairly easy to visualize or imagine the first part of taking the drink. It was all of the subtleties of the water going down the throat and as it went through into the stomach that was very different when I was actually drinking the water. I mean, there were sensations there that I wasn't able to imagine beforehand.
Mm-hmm. And was there a different quality to the kind of mind state in when you were thinking about it, when you were doing it? That's what I'm asking for you. Maybe you didn't pick that up.
I don't think I did.
Okay. We'll try it again. That's what I'm looking for. So I'll just be aware of what is mind. Who else did it? What happened?
I think I was paying a lot more attention when I was trying to think about it. When I was actually doing it,
Is that right?
It took a lot longer. Like, thinking about what I was going to do, it felt like I had time to think about, well, it's going to be cold and it's going to feel moist and how long will it be cold for? It just took a lot more time to think about all that stuff than to actually do it. It just seemed I was experiencing it faster than I was thinking about it. I tried it a couple different ways. I tried it quicker, and I tried it like with longer time.
And did you feel a difference between the two different, the mind when it was involved in the two different ways of experiencing?
Well, it seemed like when I did it quicker, that I, the experience of thinking about it and doing it were quite close together.
Mm.
And when it was longer period of time in between, there was less detail in thinking about it, or not so much less detail, but more differences.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody else?
I did it, but I found actually drinking it was much more intense or more tangible, I guess. I don't know what you'd use to describe it, but the thinking about it wasn't nearly as accurate, I guess, as the other.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think.
It's a hard question to ask, what's the difference in the mind from experiencing something at the mind or an experience something at the sense door. That's what I'm asking.
But is there a difference?
I'm not going to answer.
I'm remembering what it feels like, but when I'm doing it, my mind is still telling me this feels cold.
Is that a memory?
I don't know. It's an interpretation.
I'm asking you. See, I'm not going to answer it. I'm not going to answer it. I just want you to go back and say, is that a memory? Is that a memory? You know, what is memory? I mean, these little exercises are really deceptive, I agree. They should take you into real quagmires of interesting ground to make you start really wondering what consciousness is. That's all I do with them. I just go fishing.
Yeah.
Throw a worm out here and see what happens. So I'm not going to answer you. I'm just going to send you back with more questions.
I approve.
Very good.
I'm so glad. I do too. Yes.
In Buddhist thought, would you use sort of a map of where the positioning of your consciousness would be at a certain time? I mean, this might not be intelligible for for example, if you say, well, when we do this in imagination, my consciousness is poised more towards, if you take it, let's make a space here to the front, but when I actually do it, my consciousness recedes into another. You know, do you use grids like that at all?
If that is what the observer notices.
Right.
Okay. Not as a systematized. But it is really interesting, and it's one of the characteristics that Western science is bringing to Buddhism, that whole mapping process. And I'm very curious about what will occur from that. There's a lot of the Buddhist tradition hasn't had that kind of data to work with, you know, nor has has not used it, hasn't had the instruments to measure those things, and instead has done it a different way. This, we can measure this, this is dependable, so that we... So it has a different language structure for its maps and measurements to come out in. And as there is going to be quite an impact, I think, on the West from Buddhist ideas coming to North America or to Europe, so also Buddhism is going to be really impacted by Western thought and Western ways of measuring. So I call myself a North American Buddhist. Anybody, somebody else had their hand up for a question or something? Yes.
I was wondering about the nature of obsession and why it keeps focusing on something when thoughts are repeated and feelings.
A lot, there are many different ways of obsessing, many different ways. And the best, you know, for some obsessions, Adria and I were talking about this just lightly the other day. We were talking about, much as I dislike B.F. Skinner, I think that, you know, a little shot of behavioralism probably goes a long way. And then I reminded her how happy I was when I read that his daughter grew up and sued him. I thought that was, and she won.
Yeah,
Skinner was the man who invented behavioralism, basically, and he kept his daughter in a box for a while, Skinner box. And when she grew up, she sued him. And
oh,
won,
my.
Which I thought was behavioralism at its best. Oh, yes, oh, and by the way, it just appealed to my sense of humor. Oh, excellent. What a good theory. but I mean, there a large part of obsession is one distinct type of obsession has to do with a mental sense of what could be, as opposed to trying to make things what they are not. And it's usually based on a sense of ideal or a sense of how something should be, or right? And that tends to make one into a kind of a hungry ghost, where that which, what one is desiring, that object which it becomes the object of desire, gets more and more. Was it Karen Horney that called that the ghostly lover? Gets more and more like, kind of like the guru in the Himalayas or something, like somebody who is always perfect and you never get to ask them a question, so you never find out they're not. You know, they become more and more ideal and beautiful. And basically the way you work with that kind of addiction, where you could just get to be like a hungry ghost, no body, but you're just getting sucked out into the ether because of this ideal, possible, maybe it could be, gee, golly, gosh, stuff. And where is he, she now, and da-da-da-da. As you imagine them, and you allow the desire to really build up really well, and then you imagine a big booger hanging out of their nose. In other words, you perform the antidote, which is make them undesirable. Mm. Or you imagine them doing the one action that used to drive you nuts. Mm. Like flirting with somebody, or, you know? So whatever. You just do it. And you just feel the energy just crash. As soon as it crashes, you ground yourself in your own body. So that's if it's that kind of hungry ghost emotional. It's called meditating on the unbeautiful. You meditate on the unbeautiful. Classically, what you do is you imagine them after they've been dead for about a week, and the maggots are crawling under the skin. That's a good one for breaking the last. But sometimes in North Americans it might arouse a little anger and you might want to see them that way. So I don't advise that.
Well, why would you treat obsession differently than feeding the demon?
Feeding the demon, because when you're feeding the demon, you're feeding an internal demon. Mm-hmm. You're feeding. You would break the outer object as the obsessional object. You would break the link to the outer. You cut off the object. You have to cut off the object in order to work with the energy. So that's the first thing you do. If there is an obsessional pattern, you try to change the object of the obsession. You either move it. You cut it off by making it unsatisfactory. A friend whose six-year-old boy started picking his hair out, and he was really concerned. He didn't know what to do. He and his wife are separated, and he has the children, three boys, and this youngest one was pulling out his hair just in one spot, and he tried so many ways to. It's a really good dad. And then the kid went to stay with his mother, and she's like a no-nonsense kind of thing. She really doesn't. When she left, she just left, and she didn't get in touch with him for 2 years. And then somehow or other, a mutual friend told her that the kids really were worried. They didn't know where she was. And so she phoned them one day. And so now she sees them like every 2 weeks for a day, right? So he goes over to spend time, and she's kind of like, she doesn't want to get caught in any of this stuff, so she shaved his head. She moved the object. And he stopped.
And who cuts her in?
So, you know, it's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, move the object. There are a lot of ways to move the object. That's the first thing you need to do. You have to quit hitting on the object, number one.
So bring it back in.
And then once you've cut off the object, there's all the energy of that emotion that you've been using. So then you ground yourself in your own body. You feel your own body, and then you can do a feeding the demons or something, because then it's your desire for that that you're working with, not your desire, and that is becoming realer than you. So the first thing you have to do is, with obsession, you have to restore some kind of balance. You have to make yourself actually have at least as much weight as the object. Your own pleasure, your own sense of interest, your own pleasure. And I mean, there are different types of obsession, for sure. I mean, sometimes obsessional behavior is a conditioned state that you've learned from your parents. Very often, I have a friend who, whenever she does housework, gets into a state where you'd swear she was angry. And she cleans every nook and cranny, because that's what her mom did. And she's not really angry, she just cleaned the house the way she learned. And for some people, they almost get into an obsessional thing because they've never actually paid attention to what they are doing and what they want to do in the past. So just to bring your consciousness into it and allow your natural mind, which prefers pleasure, to operate. Rather than if the conditioned state is one of painfulness or possible mocking or, you know, abuse coming at you because you're not performing right, then maybe you need to do that action with pleasure rather than pain, and that will remove the obsessional behavior. So it so much depends on what it is and what the motive is for it. Idealism is basically really simple. If you're idealizing something outside yourself, like what you should have done and how you can visualize how you should have done it perfectly, and it's not a learning from an experience, but it's like a torturing yourself, then just bring in the unbeautiful. So imagine doing if it's an action that you perform that you can imagine how you should have done it perfectly. Have yourself doing it perfectly, and then have you know, the roof fall in because somebody left a toilet running or something. You know, like, and after all, it's impossible. It's what they used to call reality therapy, I think. In the Buddhist tradition, they call it meditation on the unbeautiful. It's very useful. That kind of hungry ghost obsession is considered to be a form of lust, and it leaves you totally out of perspective. So what you do is you just cut it by bringing in something that you can't lust for. Then you bring your energy back into your own body, you ground yourself, and then you work with your sense of that somehow something other than you is going to fulfill you. You work directly with that in your own being. This is my kind of class. I just answer questions.
In the Buddhist view, is the mind and consciousness the same thing?
They're different words. You can say vijnana, you can say citta, you can say mano, you can say ceto, you can say cetasika. There's a whole series of words you can use that all apply to a different way of using mind. Vijnana mind is, and they don't exactly translate back and forth. Vijnana mind is a bit more like the mind that names, is a bit more like that you could say.
An aspect of the mind? Or just the mind?
The naming, the quality that cognizes, right. Cognition, the cognition mind, the mind that cognizes and pulls out a name or, you know, discriminates or sets apart. It's sort of like that. It's pretty close. Vijnana. Citta is a whole different ballgame. So you talk about mind in a lot of different ways. It's really interesting to study that stuff. If you really want to study it, what you do is you get the Abhidhamma. You don't get the Abhidhamma itself. You get, you can, and it's interesting too. There's some really interesting things there. But one can tend to get bogged down. But there's a summary, a commentary on the Abhidhamma called, are you ready for this? This used to be one of my favorite things to use, this word for a walking meditation. When I was obsessed with this person who was not obsessed with me. I used to walk down the street saying, Abhidhammata Sangaha, Abhidhammata Sangaha, Abhidhamma. And it's sort of a summary of the seven books of the Abhidhamma. And I wouldn't try to read it per se, but dip into it. It's a good bathroom book. I don't know. I use books that way. There's some books that I really treasure. I put them in my bathroom because I know I'm never going to go plow. But if I'm in there, I got two or three, and I'll pick it up and I'll enjoy it really deeply for about 15 minutes, and then I say, oh my god, I gotta go. You know, like a bathtub or the toilet, either one. Good reading places. Or bedside books, but I tend to get excited about ideas, so then I'm awake for. And I'm at the bookshelf. You know. The Abhidhamma is basically based on three things, which the Tibetans call body, speech, and mind, which the Abhidhamma calls, the Theravadan tradition calls, citta, which means mind, cetasika, I'm going opposite of body, speech, and mind. So it's rupa, which is body, chetasika, which is, how about this, mental concomitants, mental states that arise together, mental groupings, filled with motive, filled with energy that creates cause and effect, which the Tibetans call speech, body. There are 52 of those, in case you weren't counting. And citta, mind. So the Abhidhamma is the teaching, all the teaching of the Abhidhamma, which is considered to be the higher teaching of mind, and quite interesting for you, I bet, is based on those three categories, citta, cetasika, and rupa. So that's one way you can look at reality. You can question, you can divide or subdivide or question or look at how things work. And the Sutta Pitaka, all the rest of the 44 volumes which make up the Buddhist Bible, and their volumes, is basically based on the five aggregates as being the division or the way of understanding. And I taught you yesterday a chant that basically works with clearing the five aggregates or the five elements, which are form, feeling, perception, mental formation, and consciousness. So either you can look at things from the point of view of five or from the point of view of three, in terms of categories or divisions or understanding levels. Now, in the Tibetan tradition, if you're going to look at the world from the point of view of three, you look at the world from the point of view of, we have three main functioning modes. One main functioning mode uses this brain, and it's got to do with time and space in the material world. And it takes data from the five sense doors, which is fed into this sense door, which then does a word search through the brain and comes up with all similar experiences, and then says, nice glasses, because of going through all past experiences of shiny things with metal hitting across somebody's nose when they're sitting across the room from me. Right? So this brain is involved with basically the past, with things that have already happened, and working with the form realm. The form realm, the causes for the form realm are in the past, not in the present. Nothing arises without cause. It's another way of saying the same thing. Whatever has arisen, the cause is in the past. So in Buddhism, you're told there is really no point in kicking the door, because what you're doing is creating a future action of a broken toe. You're not changing the present action, which is caused by the past. Therefore, approve of whatever is present. And you'll find that the material world starts to flow more easily for you. It's only smart, they say. If the causes are in the past, don't try to change them. Approve of what is present, and then you're setting the motive in process that will create better conditions in the future. Your second body is the motive body. The brain for it is here. It has three sense doors, sight, sound, and mind. And it's radiant energy, and it works with the five winds. All shaping, coming into existence, passing away, happens with those five minutes. All motive happens by how you're colored. And this body is the body that is interconnected to all other motive. Well, it is the cause and effect dancing in the here and now. This body. So if you actually are not too overwhelmed by the sense of yourself being past causes and isolated in this body, and you actually allow a little more awareness of this body, you can get more aware of like what somebody is thinking down the block or feeling, which can present itself as thoughts to you when you translate that. Or the real awareness of how the whales are doing right now off the coast of Baja, California. How many new ones have been born? Or etc. This is the interconnected dancing energy. And how it works is, if somebody walks in this room who's angry, everybody is working with anger because all of our little anger chords are strummed. You know, sympathetic music. So we are singing all the songs all the time. And this body is the mind body. This is where your mind really is, if you're a Buddhist. And now we all knew that, didn't we? It's in the stomach, right? No. That's just me. Okay. And this mind has one sense door only. And it is boundless. It's mind only. The only sense door. It's a boundless state. And it is boundless consciousness with the arising, dancing cause and effect. All potentiality, boundless consciousness. The awakened state is when you have full awareness of all three realms together and that you're not arguing one from the other. You're not treating any realm inappropriately. And that creates a fourth state, which is called Svabhavakaya, or the fourth body, or Buddhahood, or full awakening. So you have to treat each realm appropriately. You can't treat the emotional realm like the physical realm. You can't treat the physical realm like the mental realm. And if you pay attention to yourself, you'll find that there's one aspect of your consciousness that you prefer, like either you like to get the facts, you know, like where's the data? You know, is that lid over here or should it be here? You know, I want the material world to line up right. Oh yeah, it's fine for you to be spiritual, but who's going to pay? You know, who's going to buy the food? You know, like that's it. And, or maybe you're one of those people who does, oh, all life is one, when the waitress comes up with the bill. Or you're one of those people who says, but don't you feel it? Do you understand? And you have that, and that is a real strength. Whatever one of those you're operating in, that's a real strength. But what you maybe need to do is develop a little more confidence in letting the other two realms also manifest a bit more. Trust yourself, you have all three. And they each have their appropriate language for you to interact and operate with. You don't have a good perspective of the world or reality or the only and ever wonderful great mystery called you, unless you're really paying attention to all of it. You don't have a clue what your resources are. You don't open to what else is singing you into existence. Focus too much on, yeah, but who's paying the bills? You totally cut off the song of freedom or the dancing possibility of nothingness. So all three of them have their truth and have their language, and it's important to use all three. When you die, all three of them still continue, but they are altered. One of the wonderful things about being human is that there is enough control of the material world that you don't have to suffer too much. Just enough to get good questions going. And you're not so blissful as you would be in this radiant energy body that you don't want to ask questions. Now the memory of the suffering interrupts your bliss long enough. So that after you've, you know, enjoyed a wonderful night of intimacy and you've, you know, had a good meal and everything, just before you go to sleep you say, I wonder whether they've actually signed that peace treaty.
You're supposed to always remember that your moments of greatest joy is the temple's fall. That's
yeah, and there's, you know, like the Judaic tradition, I mean, there's so much beauty in it, but there's this kind of little twist, isn't there, of pride in how much the suffering goes or something, you know?
I don't know,
it's just like that one more little twist of like
the noble
sufferer or something, or the divine humor of God, and I've got a thing to tell him, or something going on there that's...
I guess I always think that you should be able to have at least one moment of bliss without having to remember the temple. Frankly, think that.
Because the temple is fine. But in Buddhism, you basically have the same teaching, but it goes like this. It says, bliss is a wonderful thing. The problem with it is that because it's so seductive, one tends to ignore what else is occurring. And when you're ignoring what else is occurring, it doesn't stop it from occurring. Yeah. You know? So it doesn't say that you should cut short your bliss. It says you should maybe try to introduce a little awareness into it. So it sounds to me like the same teaching, do you understand? But the one way of phrasing it, maybe it's better with a Yiddish sense of humor or something. Because I've roared at some of those things in the right setting. But in translation, outside of that, it can feel kind of, why not? I mean, I'm on your side, why not? And in Buddhism, they say one of the greatest causes of anger is interrupted bliss. And anger is hard to work with. So you want to avoid the anger, so you don't want to have bliss interrupted by the temple falling. You want to hear the creaks of the timber first, so you can say, dear, I think we should move, or something, you know. Something like that. Whatever. Gee, I've almost done it. I could have talked about that tonight, but I was really hoping we could just ask questions.
Cecily, first day you mentioned that there were six bardos?
There is one breakdown of it where there's six bardos. There's like the bardo of life, the bardo between life and the birth, next birth, the bardo of dream, dream. Wait a minute, now I gotta break them down. Bardo of life, bardo of dream, bardo of... I can't remember them, I'm sorry. I'll think about it. I'm sorry, I can't, it's not coming up.
Just on death again, or after the consciousness has left the body, and it stays around supposedly, or according to 49 days, or whatever.
It may or may not stay around for 49 days, but there is a very, very good chance that there won't be a reincarnation in in flash in 49 days or longer.
Maybe longer.
Yeah.
If those around are grieving that person's death, will that, for any length of time, or will the conscious stay, or will it go anyway?
I'm not, are you saying like grieving, when you say grieving, do you mean like really resisting letting them go?
Yeah, resisting letting them go.
Letting them go. So yeah. There is a really strong emotional kind of pull there.
Yeah, pull there. And will that affect the individual in terms of them going on?
It can. I mean, I know that when I was hit by the truck and I left my body, I didn't lose consciousness in the process. And the consciousness shrank down to this one little point, this wind down. And there was this little kind of little tiny, it was a bindu with this very strange, like it didn't make any, and then I identified it totally, but when I later recalled it when it came up when I was in the hospital, it didn't make sense to me at all. I couldn't figure out what it was. But it was this like little pink scene in it, kind of. But it wasn't actually a scene. It was like, I don't know, it's very hard to describe. Anyway, there was like a moving down and a seeing of that and then not seeing that and then this rush of energy and this wind and then I'm out. Mm-hmm. I'm out. And there are these two beings there, these two angels. And we're gone. And we're moving really fast, straight up. Really somebody who could not watch that, you know, it just brought up so much pain in her. So she was quite hysterical and she's screaming, why doesn't somebody do something? Why doesn't somebody? And she was screaming this. And I hear all the other stuff, you know, that's going on. This is like 10 minutes after the accident, which is, I stayed in my body and but she is just like out of it. She is like really, really unhappy, like totally hysterical. And her emotion, not even her voice, like it wasn't until I stopped that I figured out what she was saying, was just like a hook. It was just like a big grappling hook that just caught me. And I stopped. As soon as I stopped, those two angels stopped, and I turned around and looked, and my body was about that size on the road. And the legs were, I was looking down, and the legs were at this totally impossible angle. Like, I mean, it was wrong. You know, I mean, oh, that's wrong. That's wrong. And there are all these people around, and the ambulance is coming from about two blocks away. And, you know, and there's a bus going there, and somebody is stopping traffic there, you know, and people look about this tall, you know, and some of them are running around, but there's this real big circle around this body that's sprawled. It isn't particularly my body. It's just this body where those legs are really off. So, hook by her emotion. And then I'm just to finish that part of the story. Then I looked down and I looked at that body and then I realized that I was the only one who could do anything. And like that, I was back in my body. Like that. So, yeah, the emotion is a very strong thing. I mean, it's the most powerful thing because it's this, basically, this body is stronger when you leave this body. And that's what blows. That's what blows. The winds blow. And so if there is a lot of unfinished emotion by other people, it can be difficult. But what you can do when someone dies is very straightforward. You can hold a picture of when they were happy. Some little thing. Everybody was happy once. If you can't remember, ask around. You'll find some memory. You know. Maybe when they were pulling wings off flies or something. I don't know, but everybody was happy once. You find one of those small moments and you focus on it. and you think of them and you focus on that moment where they were happy. And you tell them how well they did it. You say, you really did it well. You really were the person you were, and that's such a gift. And you've done it. So feel free to go. Keep your focus, collect your energy, and go toward the light. Stay calm, keep centered. You deserve this. You did it well. You find your own grief starts to come up. Say, like you did with the feeding the demons, like a call waiting. Say, I'll get right back to you. And you do. You feel, you wiggle your toes, you feel your body, you hold yourself in your body, and you let your grief empty. You honor it. It will come up in waves. Keep a focus on your physical body and let the emotional body move. Let your emotion run through. When it dies down, it'll be two or three waves of it. You go back to that focus again. You say, thank you for being here. You did well. Yeah, and you just really affirm the wholesome. And then your own grief comes up again, or your anger, or whatever. Or maybe it's anger. And you go to that, you let it say, because that's your business. But you don't want to cut off your business either, because you're still alive. You've got work to do. Keep working. But you also want to affirm, time is not so... You know, you can do a call waiting. It's not just something for tell us. You have rights. Is that helpful? Because we'll all meet with death and meet with friends who die, so it's good to do that. And you probably feel them. You probably have a really strong sense. A really strong sense of that, you know, there is a real appreciation when someone dies of being spoken to so directly. You know, with that kind of intimacy, really recognizing their life. And if you hold a memory that makes you feel them as well living, then you can put that out emotionally really well. Well, that's what you're holding that memory for, to ground yourself well in the emotion that you can communicate it. And that will help them, it will help them a lot. That's just even, you know, just the first stages. And then at various times they go through the process of like death, rebirth again in the bardo state. And so at various times after someone has died, you'll find yourself thinking of them, or just immediately do that. Just immediately do that. Just immediately. Doesn't matter how long. You can do that. So you know them. You have that. See, nobody ever really dies in your heart. But they might need a little help through threading the needle to get out. So because you know them, you can do that. You can give them something that nobody else can give them. Your way of holding their, celebrating their life. And that is such a gift you give. That gives them so much more power in moving with clarity. Because very confusing, they don't know whether to come or go, you know. They don't know whether to respond to your pain or So you separate those two and you give that to them, and it's a wonderful gift. So I was saying about when you really feel love and are loved, then after that you're not afraid to lose. So if you feel, do you understand, love doesn't mind letting go because it's because there is love. So when you feel those parts of you that weren't loved, you just disengage for a moment. And you love yourself. You feel your own emotion. You take care of yourself. Don't hold your breath. You don't try to be quiet. You do wiggle your toes. You do remember your body. You do let the emotion move through. That's great. You keep your focus. You keep your focus. You don't deny what it is. You let it move. Then it moves through. You don't find yourself fighting to stay on top of it for 50 years. Oh, what a boring life commitment, you know. Yes, I'm trying not to get swallowed by my grief, and I've been doing it for 57 years now. I'm just about got a bastard, but... Nut. Don't do that. It's not a good career choice. There's no vacations. No dental plan. There are better things to do with you. Grieve and wiggle your toes. Stay in your body and let the grief run through. Let it be honest grief and don't swoon. Stay present. Feel yourself. Maybe you can't be present when you have a bite of a meal for like 10 consecutive bites. Maybe you can, but you can be present when you grieve. You can do it by wiggling your toes. When you're afraid, when you're angry, you can do it then. So you do that, you let the grief go, and then you can go back to the love. Because you've loved yourself, you haven't turned your back on yourself or tried to make yourself different than you are. You're even stronger in your love for the other. Is that good? Didn't answer you, did I? I took it off in my own direction.
No, you asked part of it, but the question, thing is that...
You want to know where such a person will be reborn or whether there'll be a hungry ghost forever or something like
that. Well, I mean, there's a point... I think at certain times in my family where there's a certain, I think I sense there's a certain clinging, and will that clinging keep the consciousness there?
I mean, are you talking about a recent death?
Oh, my dad's dead. Dad's dead. Yeah. And I think my sense, maybe some members of the family, not all of them, but some, is that the clinging on to that.
When did he die? He died
last May.
Yeah. A few months ago.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think what they're doing is working with their own grief now. It certainly doesn't feel like that to me. I did some prayers when you told me about it.
Yeah.
It didn't feel like that.
Mm-hmm. But I guess from their perspective, they're sort of feeling...
That's their own. That's their own.
Okay.
That's their own. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's nice to be able to separate them. Even for yourself, so you can tell the difference.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, this is my work.
Because in a sense, when you...
I tell my mother, you know, you can't die before me. It's very straightforward. Well, it's not exactly true, but she can. But she better not die until she really has to die, is what I say. She better not, like, leave something undone. Or because, I, you know, it's only right. She's the mother. She should care more for me than I care for her. That's trueness. Is there anything wrong with that? Sounds right to me. I've always treated her with more disrespect than I've always respected myself. You know, well, you know what I mean. She's supposed to suffer. She's the mother. No, that I'm not going to joke about that. That's foolish. The thing that happens when people are older and the sense of loss all around them, of things all around them, like lifestyle, children have moved out, they're all raising families, da 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 da. And then there are like basically two people left to keep a reality happening. So not only is that person losing their partner, but they're also losing the affirmation of everything that their life represented. Mm-hmm. So it's can look like grieving for their partner, but it's probably grieving for the total unsureness of what their meaning in life is anymore. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I would look at it more like that way.
Just, it was on the Vision Channel, there was an interview done with a counselor and a mother who lost her son and the whole grief that she was going through. Everybody sees it. It's quite the whole what she has to go through in terms of the adjustment, just the loss, just in terms of the family.
Yeah.
There's one last.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody there. The one last person at Christmas time. There's nobody there to call her mother, her mom. You know, the whole. Which we just said the whole.
Yeah, it's a whole.
Yeah.
And when by the time you're old, you've gone through a whole series of losses together. You know, so they're in a lot of ways too. Also, your life experience partner and your loss partner, and then they're gone. And that's a real typical one. Okay, we have a question.
Oh, but is it possible that a soul could be, you know, still living out its life on this plane, whatever language one uses?
Without a body?
Yeah, or having bodies.
Oh yeah, it's not necessary for a sentient being to have a powerful physical body so much that we can see it. It will have a different kind of physical body, but not as physical as human. I mean, there are beings who live in different realms. But I have to caution you that the word soul I find difficult. I don't know what you mean by soul.
Well, I don't know what word to use.
Yeah,
a being.
A sentient being.
A sentient being.
Yeah.
Are within Buddhism?
Can sentient beings have bodies that are not ones that humans can see easily? Yeah. Yeah, there are there such things as ghosts or.
So
yeah,
are there
sure. And zombies and
Are there rituals or something for releasing someone?
It's easier to release humans because you speak the same language. And for humans to release zombies or demons or elementals is harder because they often don't believe in them. I'll tell you a story. I was at a Dharma center in Ontario, and I was living there, and this was in the early days of this center, and there was this mama cat there who was very well fed, and she had many litters, and she was a really good mother. And the other thing she did was she taught all of her kittens how to hunt by bringing animals in still alive and lining up the kittens and then picking which one was going to catch, you know. And this was in my most purest days, because I was a recent convert. And saved me from recent converts. And especially if they're like me. And so I was like lecturing her on not killing because she had lots of food. Okay? And there was this other person there at the center who every time I would do that would get really quiet and then leave the room. Except one day he didn't. He turned around and yelled and screamed and slammed me against the wall and said, "This is terrible, you're torturing that cat." That cat has to kill. That's their instinct. They can't help it. So this was really an interesting idea to me, because my Puritan view, you know, of course, all beings wanted to stop killing, because I thought I wanted all beings to want to stop killing. It was a shocking, shocking thing. But I knew I was right. However, I deigned to ask my teacher anyway, just, you know, to be supported in my righteousness. Funny how we do that. And so, not long thereafter, I was in Toronto in a car with my beloved teacher, Namjo Rinpoche, then Ananda Bodhi. And I said, you know, sir, is it possible if there's an animal, say, like a cat, for example. For example, a cat. If they have the nature of killing, and you feed them really well, and you talk to them, and you lecture them all the time, and every time they kill, you take it away from them, and you tell them that that's like bad karma, and you want them to stop that. Is it possible that then that would actually have an influence on them, and that in the next lifetime they would not have to be subjected to that same pattern and keep repeating that pattern of murdering lifetime after lifetime? Is that possible? And he said, oh yes, yes, yes. Yes, one could do that. And indeed, and he's in the front seat, you know, looking out the window. And indeed, and I'm in the back seat hanging on every word because I'm justified. And indeed, he says, they might even, if you taught to them well, and if you were very careful about using a form of communication that would reach through to them. And, he didn't laugh, I'm laughing. And you know, when they died, especially if you were present when they died and you were able to guide them through the bardo, then certainly they could be reborn as a human. And then he turned his head toward me and looked me in the eye and said, and then one day they would come and they'd say, oh, Cecily, please help me. And you'd have to say, oh, I'm sorry. Now, if you were only a cat. He's a wicked man. You feel this beautiful gold light in your hand. It's a very beautiful light. It spreads through your body. It spreads down through your arms and legs, up through your head. Moves out through your pores in every direction, above, below, in front, behind, to the right, to the left, clockwise. Just floods out in all directions. Wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, or mind, the light just temporarily assuages it. And you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings who bear such suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings who bear such suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings who bear such suffering. Thank you for your great compassion.